Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's official. The U.S. hit the debt ceiling this week. We're $14.3 trillion in the hole. And bipartisan talks on solving the budget deficit have splintered, with the Senate's so-called Gang of Six senators down a Republican. My guest today was, famously, budget director for President Ronald Reagan. And he says now that both Democrats and Republicans have it wrong, that we need to raise taxes across the board and revamp Social Security for all, or we're headed for fiscal calamity and class warfare. This hour on Point, David Stockman on the GOP, the Democrats, and digging America out of the budget hole. You can join the conversation. Have you read David Stockman's blistering critique of Republican and Democratic plans on the deficit? Do we need big cuts and more taxes? Will Americans stomach that? Should they? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Greenwich, Connecticut, is David Stockman. He served as Republican congressman from Michigan in the late 1970s, then as budget director in the Reagan administration. David Stockman, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Very happy to be with you.
So give us the heart of your critique. Let's start with the Republicans. You're tough on both, and we'll look at both. You say the Republican plan appears, this is Paul Ryan's plan, appears to be an attack on the poor in order to coddle the rich. Give us your argument.
Well, it essentially defies fourth grade math, if you look at it. The Ryan plan exempts national security and defense spending entirely. That's $800 billion, a huge chunk of the budget. It exempts Social Security from any kind of reform, even for the better-off, more affluent recipients. That's $700 billion a year off the table. He proposes this huge plan on Medicare, but it doesn't start till 2021. That's the fiscal hereafter, and the problem is the wolf is at the door right now. We're borrowing $6 billion a month, so that's another $500 billion off the table. He then proposes that not only not to raise taxes, but actually to extend all the Bush tax cuts permanently, which would actually worsen the deficit to the tune of about $3 trillion over the next 10 years. And after doing all of those things, taking revenue off the table, the big entitlements off the table, defense off the table, he then proposes massive draconian cuts in the small part of the budget, which I call the social safety net, Medicaid, and the means-tested programs, which even in the Reagan administration days, we only tried to reform, we didn't try to crush. And a small 15% part of the budget called discretionary spending. So he takes a meat axe to those, and I'm afraid it looks to the outside world like he's trying to balance the budget, which he doesn't do, by the way, but trying to balance the budget on the back of the poor while allowing the Defense Department, the better-off retirees, and taxpayers generally off the hook entirely. This is really so wrong. We have a national crisis. We're on the edge of insolvency, and we need shared sacrifice, and it has to start not only with the rich, because I agree that the Bush tax cut should be allowed to expire, but the middle class as well. If we want all this government, we're going to have to start paying our bills. Secondly, we have got to get real about our defense situation. It is great that they got Osama bin Laden, but it's also a wake-up call because we have an $800 billion armada of defense around the world, an industrial-scale war machine that the world has never seen before, and we found this guy holed up in a dump with three wives, eight kids, and a dozen goats, and no connection with the outside world. So I think this tells us that we have to rethink our whole national security program and dramatically reduce our force structure and our budget. And I don't mean by a few billion like Obama's talking about, but by hundreds of billions over a reasonable period of time. So that's where we stand on the Democrats, Republican side. And frankly, it's just as bad on the Democratic side, and that's one of the reasons I'm as discouraged as I am.
Well, take us to that. There's the heart of your critique of Paul Ryan's big Republican plan that most Republicans have rallied behind. There's a very sharp critique of American defense spending. I'm hearing in that a kind of call for fundamental reconsideration of how we spend and operate on the defense front. Take us to President Obama and the Democrats and their part in what you call fiscal jabberwocky.
Well, it's very disappointing. The Obama administration is allegedly the most left-wing administration we've had in 50 years or longer. It is clear the Cold War is over, that we don't have industrial enemies left in the world. The Russians are busy stealing from each other, and the Chinese are busy exporting $2 trillion worth of stuff a year, most of it to us. So are they going to bomb our 3,000 Walmarts?
Maybe not.
So my point is, the Obama administration has embraced the Bush war budget hook, line, and sinker. It's $800 billion, as I said, security and defense spending. In real terms, that's 50% higher than the peak we had during the Reagan era when I was there, when we were actually up against something called the evil empire, which did have 8,000 nuclear warheads pointed at the United States. Today, you know, we're up against a ragtag band of fanatics and jihadists who are, you know, basically hiding out in the margins and bowels of the earth. Now, I'm not saying it's not a problem, but I think it's a police problem. It is not a problem for a high-tech, industrial-scale war machine that straddles the globe. So what has Obama done? Nothing. He's basically filled the positions with a lot of carryover people from the Bush era. He's, you know, the claim in the campaign was a change you can believe in, and as far as national security and defense spending, this is the same old that the public was demanding be changed.
What about the fiscal plans that he has put on the table, David Stockman, the president's plans?
Well, I'm saying the first part of his fiscal plan is to do virtually nothing about defense. Now, lately, in the last few weeks, he said, well, let's cut $400 billion over the next 12 years. The problem is, and I think this is symptomatic of the Washington problem today, they throw big numbers at the public over such extended periods of time that they're meant to confuse and obfuscate rather than be real. I mean, 12 years, $400 billion is $30 billion a year. We spend $4 trillion a year. This is such a rounding error, you can't even find it. So it's not really addressing the problem. Now, on Social Security, he doesn't want to touch it. On Medicare, he says, well, let's have some reforms and try to squeeze providers, but that's only going to save a small amount, and it'll barely offset the cost of the so-called doc fix, which we can talk about, which is a $30 billion cost that they're hiding each year in the future, but it's going to come back to bite us. Now, he's not going to cut the safety net. Okay, that's a Democratic position. I think it can be reformed, but respect that position. So when you get through all of that, you don't have any meaningful program that will affect the numbers when we're talking about this year a $1.6 trillion deficit, when we're talking about borrowing 43 cents on every dollar the government spends is borrowed. It's not coming from tax revenue. It's borrowed, and therefore it is basically a burden that we're putting on next year in our children and grandchildren and the indefinite future. So the Obama administration has no coherent fiscal plan that even begins to address the yawning magnitude of this problem.
So you've got Republicans, you say, attacking the poor, coddling the rich. You've got President Obama, essentially, you're saying, kind of wimping out here. Broad stroke, what would a Stockman plan look like?
Well, yeah, I meant to say on the Obama, and this is where my plan would be different, he's made a big thing and gives a lot of speeches attacking the Bush tax cuts and talking about, you know, the 2% on top, and I'm with him on that, and that we shouldn't be cutting lower-income Social Security recipients so that those high-income tax cuts can be extended. I agree, but he's not leveling with the middle-class taxpayers because he's extending 75% of the Bush tax cuts. for all the rate cuts for everybody except the top 2%, and many of the other provisions of the Bush cuts that we couldn't afford in the first place a decade ago, and most certainly we can't afford now.
So you, the man from the Reagan era, are saying everybody needs to pay higher taxes?
Yes, I'm saying that we're going to have across-the-board shared sacrifice if we're going to start reducing this preposterous equation where we're borrowing 43 cents on every dollar we're spending, and it has to come both from higher taxes across the board, second, from new tax sources, and I'd like to talk about that, new revenue sources, third, from a dramatic demobilization and downsizing of our global defense establishment, and then finally, through entitlement reform by means testing both Medicare and Social Security for the higher income, better off, more affluent retirees who have pensions and private assets and other sources of income. Now, until we get, I call that the red equation, revenue, entitlements, and defense, until we get major chunks of improvement out of each element of red, R-E-D, we're not going to begin to close this gap.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Ronald Reagan's budget director, David Stockman, about spending, taxes, and American debt. He says Republicans and Democrats both have it wrong, and he's very, very specific about where it's wrong. He joins us today from Greenwich, Connecticut. You can link to his recent op-ed piece, The Bipartisan March to Fiscal Madness, at our website, onpointradio.org. That was in the New York Times. We want to come to your plan, David. Let me get a couple of callers here. Alan in Fairfield, Iowa is calling. Hi, Alan. You're on the air with David Stockman.
Hello. Yes, David. And hello, Tom.
Hi.
I'd like to ask David if there's some reason why he is overlooking sources of new prosperity which are being kept out of the equation. One would be the technologies of Nikola Tesla that were sequestered after he died for free energy. Another would be electrogravitic technology for that is currently used by the United States Space Command. They have craft that are very much like UFOs that are out in space. In fact, the headquarters for the United States Space Command is no longer in California.
Alan, let me pick it up right there, if I may. I don't know exactly about Tesla and UFOs, but there's a technology question there. And there's another kind of Reagan-era question that I hear there, David. You know, why are you talking about shared sacrifice instead of shared prosperity? That was always Ronald Reagan's mantra.
Well, I think the reason is it's 30 years later, it's not mourning in America anymore. Unfortunately, we had a rip-roaring party for 30 years or longer. We borrowed more money than any other society in history, both public, private, households, business, and government. We have now buried our national economy and our individual and collective balance sheets in debt. The total debt in the country is $52 trillion. Which is three times our GDP, if you can imagine a number that big, compared to about $5 trillion back when the Reagan administration was in power. And so, therefore, we're confronted with a different set of realities and facts. Yes, it would be nice if we could get some more growth, but in the short run, we have a solvency crisis. In other words, we are borrowing so much money just to keep this economic machine limping forward that we're in danger of completely wrecking the system with too much government debt now on top of all the private debt that was accumulated prior to the crisis in 2008. So this is a totally different world. It's an unfortunate one. It's not an end game that we set out to achieve, but once the deficit started and once the two parties began to compete as free lunch parties, Republicans saying deficits don't matter and Democrats never having believed they mattered, we went through a couple of decades of extreme profligacy and irresponsibility, and we would have hit the wall sooner except the Federal Reserve stepped in and began this process of money printing, easy money, and now what they call quantitative easing, which is just another way of monetizing the debt. They're buying 100% of all the debt that's being issued by the Treasury, and so for a very short period of time, that kept the system in reasonable balance, but now that game is over. They've even indicated by June their so-called QE2 will be over. And once the Treasury stops buying, all the debt being issued to fund this out-of-control government, $6 billion a day of debt we're issuing, I think the international bond market is going to have a huge rude awakening and period of indigestion. And we're heading towards that anyway because of this debt ceiling crisis. So
let me ask you, though, it's kind of a broad pushback to your whole perspective here. A couple of big economists, Nobel Prize winners, Democrats, Joe Stiglitz, Paul Krugman, they both continue to say we need more spending to get this economy going. That will produce growth. That will produce revenues. That's kind of the Democrats' answer to the, you know, prosperity mantra of the Reagan era. Joe Stiglitz, we've heard him just recently saying this is the wrong time to put the brakes on. We will be in trouble if we do. What do you say to that?
Well, there is never any demonstration in history that you can borrow your way to prosperity after you've already trashed your balance sheet. Maybe the Keynesians were right in 1960. I doubt it, because we came out of World War II with a clean balance sheet and a strong economy. But today we have a massive embedded level of debt. And to say that let's just borrow some more in order to give people money to temporarily spend to buy, another Coach bag or pair of jeans that they can't afford or don't need isn't going to solve any problem. In fact, we've got the spending Keynesians like Krugman saying, borrow some more money, build up the debt, don't worry about it. And we have the Republican Keynesians, I call them the country club Keynesians, saying cut taxes, borrow the money to pay for it, and don't worry about it. The future will take care of itself, which really means our children and grandchildren. They're both wrong. This isn't really sophisticated economic theory. This is just plain old live for today and don't worry about tomorrow. Borrow yourself into prosperity. If it was ever possible historically, it is certainly not true today. When we look at that $52 trillion debt mountain that sits astride the U.S. economy.
So what do we have to work with in that economy? You describe in your op-ed piece rampant casino capitalism on Wall Street and a disemboweled, offshored economy on Main Street. What do we have to work with down in the engine room, David Stockman?
Well, we have really squandered our legacies, let's say, over the last 10 or 20 years. And we have lived way beyond our means because we had such easy, cheap money. People, as we know, the whole housing boom was just a backdoor way of people extracting equity from their homes that wasn't there in order to spend it on things they couldn't afford. And as a result of that process, we offshored a huge amount of our middle-class job market. We had 72 million middle-class jobs in 2000. There's 65 million today. We've lost 10% of the middle-class jobs in this economy, in manufacturing, construction, various white-collar professions, and so forth. So you're saying, what can we do about it? I think it's going to be a tough row to hoe. But I think it starts with a recognition that we can't borrow our way out of this, that growth is not going to solve the problem, that we're in a situation where austerity, sacrifice, and facing up to the day of reckoning is the first step that's necessary. There's not a remote indication out of the Beltway, out of Washington, out of the White House, out of either party on Capitol Hill, that they recognize that fundamental proposition. And until they do and start leveling with the public, we're just going to drift closer and closer to the edge.
The British have gone for austerity, and the first headline out of there is not working, big trouble, setting their own economy back on its heels. What about that example?
It is working, but people are asking for the wrong working. In other words, austerity will mean a weakened economy. It may mean higher unemployment. But the alternative is to borrow money that only defers the problem and digs you deeper into the hole. That's the point. That's essentially the core point that I guess I'm trying to get across and that Washington is totally ignoring.
Did Reagan-era policies set the table for the trouble we're in now? Did your team design this, David Stockman?
Well, I think to some degree, once we started down the path and we overdid it on the tax cut, Reagan did then take back 40% of the tax cut that was excessive through tax increases over the next several years. But somehow we came out of the 1980s in the Republican Party with a revisionist theory of history, a theory that said the recovery of the 80s, which basically I would attribute to killing inflation and the tough role that Volcker played at the Fed, all was due to the tax cuts of 1981, and that deficits no longer matter. So once the Republicans signed on for that mantra, which then Dick Cheney, who should have known better, propagated endlessly, including in the early days of the Bush administration. Yes, I think the misstated legacy of the Reagan period, which was embraced by the Republican Party, is one big part of the problem. But the main part of the problem was the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve funded through easy money, zero interest rates, endless infusions of liquidity into Wall Street, a totally unrealistic, unsustainable spree of speculation and asset appreciation that is part of what I call the casino capitalism that is seriously impairing the capability of our current economy.
David Stockman, I know we have to let you go. Last question. You've put this big view out there, and it's hard-edged and tough, and it really spares nobody. Do you have Republicans or Democrats calling you, quietly, secretly in the night saying, David, I'm on board, how do we do this, or radio silence?
Well, I don't think there are many active partisans in the debate down there who are asking me about this. Although a few have encouraged that I continue to speak up. But there are tons of people in ordinary life that I run into constantly who can see the facts of life for what they are and are in complete agreement. So I think our problem is the professional politicians have been repeating their mantras and their catechism and ritualistic ideology for so long that they no longer can see the reality that most people who work for a living every day can see quite clearly. So I think it's a matter of time. Sooner or later, we will have the wake-up call. I'm afraid it may be a rude shock in the bond market or the currency market or the financial system generally, but we will get a wake-up call one of these days.
David Stockman, he was budget director for President Ronald Reagan from 1981 to 85, author of Triumph of Politics. His op-ed piece, The Bipartisan March to Fiscal Madness, you can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. David Stockman, it's always a pleasure to have you. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Let's turn to Washington, see if any of this might be accomplished, and how. Gail Chadwick joins us, senior congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
You've been listening in, and so have a lot of our listeners. If I may, Gail, let me turn right to them for their questions on the David Stockman view of things. Stuart in Buffalo, New York. Stuart, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. Hi, Gail. It would have been nice to ask David. He did address part of my questioning and comment, but I've been looking at tax policy and debt for about two decades, both in academia and in private industry, and it just doesn't seem like we have anybody out there that is really seriously looking to address the problem. And I think David addressed that with his last question or his last comment, but you've got the Republicans who are blind to any revenue increases, and you've got Democrats that won't address the major drivers of the deficit, which are Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And it seems to me like there's no one out there. And so I guess one question for Gail is there anyone in Washington that she's talking to, anyone in any sort of policy position that is actually seriously looking at both sides of the equation, because we really need to fix both sides.
Stuart, let us pick it up right there, if we may. And I thanks for your call from Buffalo. Gil Chadwick, how about it? Is there a team in Washington that says the problem is so big, it's going to require austerity, it's going to require cuts to spending and taxes, maybe across the board, as David Stockman says?
There is. The group I've been watching grew out of the President's Fiscal Commission, which produced a fairly draconian and original, compelling.
Is the Bowles-Simpson commission?
Exactly, mm-hmm. Which was pretty much ignored by everyone except the Gang of Six, four of whom were members of the group and who have been working ever since December now to try to put into law some of the concepts in that bill, which is a model of shared sacrifice.
But this was the Gang of six senators, three Republican, three Democrat, working on this, talking about it, working on it, working on it, until yesterday Tom Coburn of Oklahoma bailed. So now it's five, and people are saying that effort may be over.
That's it. But the Coburn case, he asks who there is willing to take incoming fire on issues, and I think Coburn is exhibit A. I think the most interesting thing about what he's done hasn't gotten a lot of attention. He's challenging the definition of what it means to cut a tax. Now, it seems that that would be obvious. Republicans say, you know, taxes are off the table. But he took one, the ethanol credit, tax credit, and he said, look, this is so egregious. It does so much damage to the environment, to food prices, to energy costs, that it's worth getting rid of on its own terms.
Tom Coburn said this, and he's from an energy state, but he was attacked immediately by anti-tax Republicans.
Because it violates the tax pledge by Americans for Tax Reform. This is a pledge that's been signed. It started actually on Reagan's watch in the mid-80s, and it's been signed by most Republicans, some Democrats in conservative states, and it has had, I think, an enormous impact in driving Republicans to what they consider a bright line, that is, taxes off the table. That's what's interesting about Coburn. He's redefining what it means to cut a tax. A tax credit by this tax code is the same thing, cutting a tax credit is the same thing as raising a tax bracket. Coburn's saying, no, look at it in a dynamic way. Look at the impact it will have on, in effect, what people pay at the pump. Getting rid of it's a good thing.
So that's a kind of conceptual change that would, if people adopted it, give more Republicans running room to have a little more flexibility here. But he got pounced on. He got knocked around, Grover Norquist and others, and he's out of the Gang of Six. Now, does that mean that the heat was too hot in the kitchen for Tom Coburn?
I don't think there's such a thing as heat too hot for Tom Coburn. He's a fire-breathing dragon in the House. He came to the Senate, and we were all writing stories saying he's going to torch the place because it's so easy in the Senate for one man to obstruct things. Instead, he's become a statesman of sorts. He works across party lines. He worked with Senator Obama on very important transparency legislation, and he's taking fire from all sides on this critically important issue. He says he's not out of it. He says it's a pause. A lot of personalities going on here, but it really, I was very interested in what David Stockman said about the month of June.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We've been hearing today from Ronald Reagan's budget director, David Stockman, about spending, taxes, and American debt. He is saying these days that Republicans and Democrats both have it all wrong. And this voice out of the Reagan Revolution era come back 30 years later to say, wake up, we need a different approach. His approach? Spending cuts, hello Democrats. Taxes, more taxes, hello Republicans. And for Americans, he says, we're going to have some austerity. Gil Chadwick, who's senior congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, has been kind enough to step in right here with us. She's been listening along with us, along with you, to David Stockman today, and is ready to look at what his line of analysis may face on Capitol Hill. Gil, we've got a lot of questions and comments on Stockman and on your analysis as well. Let's go to Omaha, Nebraska, and Carrie. Carrie, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Sure thing. Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm calling with a comment more than a question, and I also just offering my perspective as the spouse of an officer in our armed forces.
Okay.
And, of course, the U.S. government provides everything that we have in his paycheck every week, and
right.
I'm a stay-at-home mom. Despite all of that, I could not agree more with Mr. Stockman, and what he said really resonated with me.
On cutting military spending or reconceiving how we do military?
Well, on most of the things that he said, mm-hmm. I do believe we should raise taxes across the board. I think we should eliminate the tax cuts for the wealthy. And, you know, I say that my husband and I have a combined net worth in the millions of dollars. And despite that, and despite the fact, as I said, that the government provides our paycheck, I do believe we should cut military spending. We need to make cuts on both sides of the aisle. And what he said about sacrifice and austerity resonated with me particularly, because I do feel that, you know, as a society, we have become so consumerist-oriented, and I don't think there is an awful lot of fiscal discipline in many of the households in America.
Carrie, I don't know. I guess you didn't make your net worth through your husband's military service, which we appreciate, but what about Stockman's call for cutting back in the military? Does your husband see room for cutting our spending there?
Absolutely. And I can't speak to spending in the theater. Obviously, we are overextended all over the world, in my opinion. But I mean in the sort of day-to-day operations in our United States military, and specifically places like Washington, D.C., the office jobs, the support role that happens outside of those that are sort of in harm's way on the front. There's tremendous amount of waste. And it's just an example of that is, you know, airline tickets being purchased for government business 3 or 4 days before a flight. And obviously things come up at the last minute. But by and large, there is a culture of, you know, contracted business and, in my personal opinion, an excess of spending that could easily be remedied. But again, it's just part of the culture.
Carrie, I appreciate your call very much. Gail Chaddick, let's look at We May. If we may, there's Carrie calling, a military family calling in. You heard David Stockman on military spending in this country. He's calling for a real stem-to-stern reconsideration of that, not the kind of cuts, I guess, that Secretary of Defense Bob Gates and President Obama are talking about, but a real deep reconsideration of that. Do you hear rumblings of that in sitting congressmen and senators, Gail?
You know, on the Democratic side, yes, but it is more subdued because there is a Democrat in the White House. The alliance now for spending are Republicans and President Obama, who does not want to look weak on defense, wants to resolve Iraq, Afghanistan in a way that's
mm-hmm.
credible,
mm-hmm.
And doesn't want to pull the plug on it. But I think what could pull this together, there was the defense hearings going on right now. You're hearing Republicans and Democrats. I think taking account of the toll on military families of a decade-long war,
mm-hmm.
you know, and constant deployments, and what is that doing to the fabric of the military. I think that's the issue that I think could have, but it's not going to happen until after the election, that could have an impact on radically rethinking the military.
Maybe those wars have to be wound down before the radical rethinking can take place. Looking a little broader, here's a comment online from Dean Gale. He says, I never thought I would say this, but David Stockman is exactly right about what needs to be done. He says, Paul Ryan and the other experts in Congress are absolutely wrong when they say we don't have a revenue problem. We have a spending problem. Now, let's look at this on the Republican side, because that is sort of core orthodoxy at the moment in the fiscal debate anyway. No revenue problem, but a spending problem. We hear that again and again from Mitch McConnell and others. Do you see wiggle room there? Maybe is in the redefinition of what a tax is, or anywhere else in any readiness to say we may have to work both sides of this equation toward a solution in the GOP, Gail?
I do. I really think the heart of it isn't tax rates. I think there you're going to get maximum pushback from Republicans. It's all the spending that's gone on in the tax code, year after year after year.
And by that, you mean tax breaks, for
tax
you name
breaks.
It.
It's called tax expenditures, but it amounts to the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I could give you, you know, Tom Ashbrook Enterprise, a subsidy straight out of the tax code, billions of dollars.
Okay.
Or I could give you a tax credit. Now, the tax credit is invisible. It just goes on year after year. It doesn't come up in the appropriating cycle. It's like layers of rock in the Grand Canyon. And both sides admit that the nation's tax code has become absurd. And that, I think, was the genius of the Bowles-Simpson Commission. Let's zero out all of those tax breaks. Zero.
Mm-hmm.
And use the savings to pay off the deficit and, important point, lower the tax rates. That, I think, is the heart of what could be a compromise on this, but it requires breaking into the notion that all those tax breaks are as critically important to Republicans as the tax rates.
What about his analysis as a Republican here, thinking about, he's saying the Republicans have sort of ossified in a position. Meanwhile, there's 30 years of change in the global economy, the U.S. economy that's gone on, and the old mantras aren't up to it now. Of course, this is David Stockman, who was famously taken to the woodshed back in the Reagan era when he wasn't completely on board even then, within the ranks of the GOP. Is there a deeper reconsideration going on of the way the Reagan legacy has been interpreted or preserved or maybe pickled over the years? Do you hear any of that, or is that heresy, Gail?
Oh, it's pretty much heresy. I think what's interesting about the David Stockman story, and we ought to be talking about that, is Reagan came in with this notion that if you cut revenue, Congress will cut spending, and that didn't happen. I mean, that was
so the taxes got cut, but the spending went right on, and
that's right.
Therefore, deficit.
And we just got used to the idea that deficits were okay. I think he was dead on when he said that to have Republican administrations somehow get used to that and say debt isn't a problem is going to take some accounting for that. That could be a critical mistake. But as I started to say before the break, the most interesting thing he said was this new deadline that I don't hear many people talking about. There are two deadlines in Washington right now: August 2nd,
the debt ceiling,
when the debt ceiling is supposed to be critically breached and we go into default. There's a big debate now as to whether that's a real deadline. Pat Toomey, senator from Pennsylvania, yesterday gave a speech at the American Enterprise Institute that said we don't need to worry about that. All we need to do is to prioritize paying first our debtors, and then we really won't be in default. So that's one deadline. The other deadline is, of course, November 2012. That's on everyone's mind. But the idea that in June the Federal Reserve stops buying bonds, that is very interesting. And it's something that members talk about, but quietly. I mean, what would happen if we gave a bond auction and no one came? Right now, the Federal Reserve is buying a lot of those bonds. Well, if no one comes, we're Greece. And that, I think, is a critical point that
But there's nothing operating on that timetable, is there, Gail? I mean, John Boehner is saying, if you want to go through the debt ceiling, we've got to cut trillions. But nobody's talking about that happening before June.
No, not yet. I think they're going to listen to your show, and it's all going to change tomorrow. Everyone's going to be talking about June. I hope they
will. I don't know. Here's Mark online saying, amen, I'm a progressive who thinks a Reagan man, David Stockman, has it right. I don't know. Joe in Newburyport, Massachusetts. Joe, what do you think?
I think that it makes such common sense. I cannot understand or fathom why more people aren't on board, especially the Democrats, why they're not pushing harder. I think it's fear. Again, an example of Democrats being kind of spineless. I happen to be an independent, progressive independent.
Okay.
But I can say personally, my wife and I make under $100,000, and I would be willing to pull up my bootstraps and pay a little bit more in taxes right now. I think it was Benjamin Franklin, I'm not sure, maybe someone correct me on this, said taxes buy civilization. I think we should all be willing, we're not the upper class. The upper class, it's unconscionable that they're not coming out more strong, that they're not willing to pull up their bootstraps and contribute. I know it's the whole economic thing, but I think David Stockman sets everything right on the table. Let's take a good look at what he has to say. he's got a lot of credibility, and I think it just makes such common sense.
Hey, Joe, we're doing it. I hear you, Joe, but let me ask you, what about the sort of Joe Stiglitz view, big economist, Nobel Prize winner, saying this is the wrong time to cut back on spending? We need to be making investments that will make jobs, that will make, you know, revenue, prosperity, and therefore help us right the boat. What about that view?
Of course, I agree with that, but we also have to be willing to pay more taxes right now. That we're leaving that off the table, which is unconscionable. Yes, what he said, of course, but we all have to be willing to pay more taxes right now in the short run to get us back in business.
Joe, we've got it. I appreciate your call. One more, Phil in Boston. Phil, you're on the air.
Well, I just would like to, as a Democrat and a progressive, I echo the comments of other callers that what Stockman said is like a breath of fresh air. And, you know, in some ways, it's the politicians reflect what we as the voters, what they think anyway, that we feel. And I think that what Stockman described as both the Democrats and the Republicans being unwilling to really tackle the real issues in this, it's really up to us as the people here, and hopefully enough people who are open-minded and independent voters and whatnot will hear what Stockman is saying and push their elected representatives to start adopting some of these real ideas.
It's going to take a lot of push, but maybe you're right, Phil. I appreciate your call as well. Let me get one more right here, Gail, from Bamberg, South Carolina. Brian's calling. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Yes, sir. What's on your mind?
Well, I just want to say that I totally agree with what David Stockman said. I've been feeling that way for a long time and thinking that both parties were off track. But I was real interested in Gail's opinion of the Bowles and Simpson coalition agreement,
mm-hmm.
and whether she thought this stood any chance of passing, and whether or not she thought it went far enough to solve the problem.
Let's put it to her, Brian. Thank you for your call. Gail, what about it? Bowles Simpson, the president couldn't get Congress to embrace it, but he made it his own plan. But then he has not himself really pushed for the full enchilada there, and Brian wonders if maybe more would be necessary.
Oh, I think definitely. I mean, that is the surprising thing, that the president didn't get behind it more. But I think the Bowles Simpson stepped off, didn't get into what is a huge element of the problem, and we haven't talked about it yet either, which is health care costs. Just set it off for another day. But, you know, the health care plan that passed Congress and is now in the process of being implemented.
The Obama plan. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Doesn't deal with health care costs either, the increase in cost. It taxes more. It increases access, but it doesn't deal with cost. So I think that's another element to this problem. Some of the groups that pushed for health care reform are talking about this privately, but with so much else on the table right now, it's hard to find any oxygen to take on an issue that difficult.
I want to come back to I think the heart of Brian's question about whether there might be some bipartisan crowd that would get together around something like that. But one more call, if I may, for Sturbridge, Massachusetts. Jim's calling. Jim, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
You know, I agree with virtually everything that David Stockman's plan says. There's only one area that it makes me a little queasy, I guess, is when you talk about means testing Social Security and Medicare. You know, now we get to a situation where we're not all in the same boat together, and it becomes more of a welfare program, depending on the level of the means testing. And once it's a welfare program, well, we've seen what happens to them. The people who are on welfare are always targets, and those programs are always ripe for cutting. And I wonder if if that's a first step almost towards dismantling those two programs once you make it so that we don't all have a stake in it.
Jim, our time is short. Let's take it straight to Gail. Gail, is there a constituency for means testing on that front? And you hear the fear. It's the sort of time-honored fear there. You begin to means test on Social Security, Medicare, and pretty soon the rest gets shot down to what's the political viability of that path?
Oh, he's right. There is a great fear that once you open the door to that, you lose your support for the whole concept. Democrats have put it off the table for the most part. But I think there are some things that are going to force, like, I guess, the bond deadline that our show is now going to popularize, that are going to force consideration of that. And look at the report that came out this week. Social Security, for the second year in a row, is having to take from current tax revenues, that it's going to run out, even if you just look at the IOUs a year earlier, and Medicare, it's just dropped back 5 years. You know, reality is intervening here. It's not possible to simply hunker down in these established positions. Reality is intervening, and the option is not, you know, do nothing on Medicare or hurt it with reform. If you do nothing, you kill it.
Of course, the question is, does reality intervene in such a way that it even intervenes in the debate in Washington? I mean, it seems as though the odds seem to me to be that we're going to go right through this summer, this tough summer, with the same battle lines and the same debate while reality dances outside the door.
I don't think reality will intervene until November 2012. That is my depressing conclusion to the day.
Well, we won't be depressed. We'll look at the insights we've got here, the way people respond to them, and maybe a different way forward, a less polarized way forward that we may need to take to make, what, to make everything happen, to hold things together here. Gail Chadwick, you are terrific to come in behind David Stockman today, and we're grateful for your time. Thank you so much for joining us, Gail.
Thank you, Tom.
Gail Chadwick, Senior Congressional Correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And listeners, again, at our website, you can link to David Stockman's pretty hot op-ed. It is something to read. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.